Hey, Corey here. We've had an influx of new listeners, and so I just want to make sure that if you are new to the podcast, you don't just jump in and start listening to these daily episodes, which we've been doing. Please go back and listen to the first at least 8 episodes so you have an idea of what Collapse is, what it is that Corey is talking about. Also, if you've been with us for a while and you're enjoying the content, please join us on Patreon. We would love to see you there. There's a link, as always, in the description.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
As we approach the end of the year, we're starting to get into holiday season. There may be some days in which I am not posting an episode, especially around the holidays. So Thanksgiving in the U.S. is this next Thursday, the 27th. I am not going to be posting on Thanksgiving, nor am I going to be posting the day after Thanksgiving. The reason for not posting on the day after is that typically I record on Thursdays. The content for these This Week in Fascism episodes, and, you know, I'm going to be spending some time with family that day. Well, with that, let's dive into the news from this last week. You know, on the fascism front, this week was an interesting one. You know, there are many articles that we're going to talk about that are similar to other weeks in as much as the continuing corruption and the ongoing threats. But there's also a few wins. I'm a little bit cautious to call them wins. But it does feel like we're hitting sort of a critical point for the Trump administration in which they are going to have to pretty much decide if they're going to go full on fascism or whether or not the Supreme Court or other courts have any power left. We'll also, I believe, be finding out if and how much popularity matters and whether the Trump administration can continue on as support dwindles. So to start off, let's talk about some of the big news around the Epstein files. Once Aralita Grijalva was sworn in, it became inevitable that the petition to release the Epstein files was going to pass and that a vote was going to be required. Now, because of this, it seems that seemingly out of nowhere, Donald Trump, Mike Johnson flipped and sort of supported the vote. With that support, the House basically almost unanimously voted to release the Epstein files. There was only one, Clay Higgins, who voted no. His claim was that it was to protect the victims, even though that clause is already in the law requiring that any victim information be redacted. From there, that very same night, it went to the Senate, where it also passed through. And the next day, this last Wednesday, Donald Trump signed the bill into law. Now that it's been signed, it gives the DOJ, the Department of Justice, 30 days to release the information to the public. It does have some clauses in there where information can be redacted for national security threats, for ongoing investigations, but it strictly requires that no information can be redacted simply for the cause of saving someone in embarrassment or their political career. Now, it can be argued, obviously, that the Department of Justice likely has already redacted or changed much of the information in the files to protect Trump or other high-profile Republicans or wealthy individuals. That said, the Department of Justice will also have to testify in front of Congress and explain any changes that they made to the files or any redactions and why those were necessary. Now, these files are massive. I saw someone compare it basically to 10 phone books worth of information. We're talking about documents and flight logs and emails and pictures and photos and all sorts of evidence. It will take a lot to go through those files. And there is a very good chance that, of course, you know, the House is not going to be able to identify every area that's been redacted or changed. And so no doubt much of any sort of criminalizing evidence is gone. Trump and Johnson would likely not have flipped and turned to support it if they didn't feel confident that there was some way in which they could remove information, you know, or that they would be kept safe. This may be, like I said, by the information itself having been redacted, or it may be that the Trump administration plans to open up this new investigation, which would lead to them having the excuse of not releasing the files. Basically, Trump told Bondi to look into Democrats because now suddenly the Epstein files do exist, according to Trump, and that it's filled with Democrats. And so Clinton and others need to be investigated. And he's demanded that the Department of Justice open an investigation. So the fear is that with this open investigation now, the DOJ will simply say we can't release these files because they are part of that investigation. It would be a clear, obvious excuse, but they have done that several times now, and they seem to keep getting away with it. So it will be, you know, yet to be seen in the coming days, and they have those 30 days left. I guess at this point it's down to 27 or 28 days to release the files. And so, yeah, we'll see what happens there. When one reporter asked Trump the following, he said, "Mr. President, why wait for Congress to release the Epstein files? Why not just do it now?" Because Trump has been able to just do it. This didn't need to go through a vote. He could have ordered the DOJ to release these files. Trump responded, "It's not the question that I mind, it's your attitude. I think the license should be taken away from ABC. We have a great commissioner, a chairman, Brendan Carr, who should look at that." Pretty much all of the questions this week asked of President Trump have been responded to in this way, calling reporters piggy, demanding to know what networks they're from. And instead of answering the question, he simply says, "You're fake news. You're the worst. Your network is awful," et cetera, et cetera, and refuses to ever answer the question. Thomas Massie, who was one of the Republicans who really stood out and refused to back down from signing this into law. He was one of the ones that inspired other Republicans to follow suit. He says the following. He says, "They're part of the cover-up. Speaker Johnson's press conference shows he's unrepentant. They have a backup plan, and I think it's going to work poorly, by the way." And that is my hope, and that is what I've seen many people's hopes is, that, you know, they may think that they have redacted enough from the files, but because of the sheer amount, the sheer volume of information and data there, that they will miss something, or that they will miss many somethings. Reports are that they've had 1,000 FBI agents combing over this information for the last who knows how many months. But with the amount of data that we're talking about, you know, we're going from this having the eyes of 1,000 people trying to scrub and clean it up to the eyes of millions and millions of people who will hopefully be able to, you know, sort through it and find things that that didn't get fixed. And of course, the real hope is that there are multiple copies, that what the FBI has been working to redact and change can be shown to be false, you know, by others who may have access to this information, especially in as much as that information is digital. So anyway, to end this topic of the Epstein files, it really could go any direction. People like Marjorie Taylor Greene seem to think that Trump's going to get destroyed by this. She has suddenly gone from being sort of lunatic, fringe, extremist right wing to more centrism. And I think the obvious play here is that she intends to be sort of the figure that precedes Donald Trump. So it feels like there's just such a wide range of outcomes possible, ranging from continued excuses and absolutely no justice, no new information, ranging from that to, you know, being highly incriminating, but only against Democrats, to being the very thing that could bring down the Trump administration, could bring down the GOP, and could bring down Democrats, and could bring down the wealthy elite, the billionaires. I think it's wishful thinking to have that high of hopes. The reports themselves, the files may end up being very underwhelming with the information that we're able to get from them, but time will tell. And of course, we will touch back on this as we find out. All right, moving into some of the corruption that we learned about this week in the Trump administration, and staying on the topic of sexual trafficking, the White House intervened on behalf of accused sex trafficker Andrew Tate during a federal investigation. Federal authorities were chided for seizing electronic devices from Tate and his brother and told to return them, records and interviews show. Experts said the intervention was highly inappropriate. So this was posted in ProPublica this week. And it just goes to show the type of people that the Trump administration works to protect, the illegal ways in which they do it. And it's just despicable to me that these are the folks they choose to protect and that Trump's followers are okay with that. In commondreams.org, there's an article titled, "Americans Should Be Enraged. Reports Expose Unprecedented Corruption at Trump Department of Justice." Someone said, "I wouldn't even call it the Justice Department anymore. It's become Trump's personal law firm." And we've seen time and time again, as Donald Trump has commanded Bondi to go after someone, to prosecute someone. That's not the way the Department of Justice is supposed to work. It says, in a lengthy story published on Sunday by the New York Times, the former DOJ attorneys described rampant politicization of prosecutions, directives to dig up evidence on Trump's political foes, and orders to drop investigations into potential terrorist plots and white-collar crimes. Several attorneys told the paper that the corruption of the DOJ began on Trump's very first day in office when he issued a blanket pardon to everyone who had been convicted of rioting at the U.S. Capitol building on his behalf on January 6, 2021, in the last-ditch effort to prevent the certification of former President Joe Biden's electoral victory. Mike Romano, a prosecutor who worked on January 6 cases, said that he had to resign as soon as he saw the broad scope of the pardons, which included rioters who were guilty of assaulting police officers. Quote, it's incredibly demoralizing to see something you worked on for 4 years wiped away by a lie. I mean, the idea that prosecution of the rioters was a grave national injustice. We had strong evidence against every person we prosecuted. Now, this article goes on to talk about more and more of the corruption inside of the Department of Justice, and I will link it in the description so you can read through it. Well, that article talks about the pardons of the January 6th defendants. Well, guess what? Trump re-pardons a January 6th defendant to erase an unrelated gun conviction. So this was another pardon to one of those individuals. And it says the new pardon ends a legal clash over the limits of Trump's sweeping day one clemency for those who stormed the Capitol. So for the second time, he pardoned someone named Dan Wilson, a militia member who joined the Capitol riot on January 6th. He was also convicted of illegally possessing firearms in his Kentucky home. So after Trump erased Wilson's felony conviction for his role in the riot, he then pardoned him once again for owning weapons he should not be owning. What's really upsetting about this to me is just that Trump is basically signaling to his followers that crimes committed to those who are loyal to him can be pardoned. And that's scary. If he continues to call for violence or call for death or imprisonment or whatever of his foes, it's not even a stretch at all for me to imagine him pardoning a murderer for carrying axe in Trump's name. We may very well see this with all of the issues regarding ICE as individuals begin to be prosecuted for acts they are committing, in the name of Border Patrol or Customs Enforcement. Trump will likely make sure to pardon anyone who suffers any legal consequences. So that being applied on a broader scale is pretty terrifying to me. An article in Yahoo talks about how Trump diagnoses Seth Meyers with incurable case of Trump derangement syndrome after Epstein barbs and demands that he be fired. We've already seen Trump's pressure leading to the firing of other individuals. He's been going on about Seth Meyers now for a few weeks, and I guess this will just show us if he continues to push in the way that he pushed with Kimmel and if he will be successful, even temporarily, like he was in that case. Trump administration removes report on missing and murdered Native Americans, calling it DEI content. This is from an organization called Oklahoma Watch, and the article says this. The Trump administration took down a congressionally mandated report on missing and murdered Native Americans from the Department of Justice's website nearly 300 days ago to comply with an executive order against diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's still not back online, and the senators who worked to pass the law are furious. The Not One More report was the product of the Not Invisible Act of 2020, meant to provide tribes with solutions to combat the epidemic of missing and murdered indigenous people and educate the general public about the crisis. The act was signed into law by President Donald Trump in his first term. Senator Catherine Cortez Masto, a moderate Democrat from Nevada, who sits on the Senate Indian Affairs Committee and introduced the act, said this, "It is astounding that an administration that actually signed these bills into law that wants to address the issue of keeping our communities safe from violent criminals, including our tribal communities, thinks that this isn't an important issue." The report was taken down amid a purge of material from federal websites that the Trump administration deemed DEI-related. The blatant racism, the blatant disregard for minorities is chilling. It's heartless. It's cold. To remove this, almost a year ago, to know that it's been removed, it'd be one thing if there was this mass, like, AI-guided removal of stuff, and then they went back and cleaned it up and made sure to put back the things that they had taken out and issued an apology for the oversight. But no, it is a clear and blatant disregard, in this case, for Native American lives. On the topic of a clear and blatant disregard for the well-being of minorities, this article from CBS News is titled, Only 16 of over 600 detained by ICE in Chicago area have criminal histories, records show. So Donald Trump, who campaigned on this idea of deportations and ICE raids, but promising only to get rid of the worst offenders, the worst of the criminals, the murderers, the thieves, the rapists, whatever, whatever, now shows that 16 out of 600 had any sort of criminal history at all. The article says that the Trump administration has released the names of 607 people detained by immigration agents and whose arrests might have violated a court order. And only 16 of them have been identified by the federal government as a high public safety risk because of their alleged crimes or criminal histories, according to court documents. The list is topped by 16 people deemed by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement as a high public safety risk because of their alleged criminal histories. Charges include aggravated assault, DUI, domestic battery, and kidnapping. One person was deemed a national security risk, and another was identified as a foreign criminal, but no details were given. Now look, I am fine with going after criminals. If someone is a rapist, they should be arrested, whether they are documented or not. Criminals should be prosecuted, especially for these types of crimes against other individuals. But when you arrest 600 people and less than 3% of them have committed the types of crimes that you are reportedly going after, that you're purportedly targeting, it shows that everything that's happening here is just completely discriminatory. It's for show. And the whole promise up front was a lie. And yet, is there any outrage from MAGA? No. I know people who have said or made the excuse when the idea of ICE is brought up that, hey, they're taking only the criminals and they're taking criminals off the street. And then you point out an arrest of someone and they will make an attempt to point out how that person must have been a criminal. But then what happens when you show them data like this? Oh, well, they're here legally. They made the choice to come here and so they need to go. Eric Ballier, a retired special agent with Homeland Security Investigations, worked for the department until last year after 25 years on the job. He said that the data regarding the ICE arrests erodes trust in the federal immigration crackdown in the Chicago area, in particular the Trump administration's repeated claims that they are targeting the worst of the worst. It confuses the public. It certainly instills a sense of fear, he said. To go after violent criminals, that's a lot of work. That's a lot of effort. That's a lot of time. And candidly, from the people I've talked to, the department and the agency doesn't want to expense that time, that strategic and operational planning to actually get the worst of the worst. So yeah, it's much easier just to find brown people on the street and arrest them, deport them, and maybe hope to catch a few criminals in the process. The government's own data shows that 78% of the 607 people detained by federal immigration agents between June 12th and mid-October pose a low risk to public safety, while a total of 7% are considered high risk, though not all of those considered high risk even have criminal histories. Only 2.6% of those 16 people have criminal histories that the federal government deemed make them high risk. That's not a good percentage, to say the least, Ballier said. I think it runs contradictory to what has been perpetuated over the last several months, where this is a targeted enforcement operation designed to go after kind of the worst of the worst. All right, now to end the episode, let's take a look at, I don't know, I labeled these as wins. Maybe that's giving them too much weight, too much hope. But these are just some of the areas in which I think it makes me happy to see, because these pile up, and hopefully they pile up enough to cause any sort of delay in Trump's momentum, a stumble in this push forward towards fascism. So one is this from the AP. Federal judges block Texas from using its new U.S. House map in the 2026 midterms. A quick catch up on this story. Essentially, Texas gerrymandered the crap out of their voting districts, and they did so along racial lines in order to win more seats for Republicans in the House. I can't remember the exact number that it was going to give them, but it was substantial. It was like 6 or something like that. And it would have completely ensured that Republicans took over the House or kept the House, and that Democrats could not win, probably ever again. California and Governor Newsom responded by putting forth a vote which allowed, if it passed, for a redistricting to happen in California as well, which would conversely give Democrats a higher number of seats. This essentially counteracted the Texas maneuver. But guess what? Texas did it illegally. There was no vote, and they did it along racial lines. This went against the Voting Rights Act. And that is what the courts are saying. The Department of Justice has attempted to sue Governor Newsom and the state of California for their gerrymandered map. But if things continue the way that they sit currently, It seems like there is not much ground for that to have any sort of weight, and California's map should remain, and Texas may lose theirs, which would, on the opposite end, ensure a Democrat victory in the House come the midterms. Now, of course, this will probably or possibly find its way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court may decide to delay it and allow the map to stand. And of course, they may find themselves delaying it until after the midterms. It's all a possibility and it's yet to be seen, but it's a step in the right direction. And I'll reserve a little place in my heart for hope in that front. Earlier this year, Donald Trump had commanded Bondi and the Department of Justice to go after James Comey. I won't go into the details of that case, but essentially what just happened was that it turns out that the prosecutors had not presented the correct case or the correct indictment to the grand jury. And so what they ended up submitting was not the same as what had previously been presented. This is a major misstep and may cause serious complications or even have the case thrown out against Comey. The hope is that as Donald Trump seeks to prosecute more and more his political opponents, that he finds these sort of missteps and that the law will uphold the fact that they're being done illegally and that there really simply is just no case against them. How this ends up going will demonstrate what kind of grasp on power Trump has, not just in the ability to indict them in the first place or go after them, but to actually successfully prosecute them. An article in Slate.com talks about why it matters that Trump's DOJ got caught by a judge blatantly lying again. This is not in reference to anything we've talked about so far today with the DOJ. It's yet another version or another example of the DOJ acting unlawfully. I mean, in this case, it's referring to the nationalization or the federalization of the National Guard, I should say. We talked previously about how the Justice Department got caught red-handed lying about the facts of why they sent the National Guard to Oregon, and they were caught once again lying. There's a lot of commentary about this basically saying if there's no consequences, then it doesn't matter. If they're just going to keep lying and keep getting away with it, then it really doesn't matter at all that they're being caught in their lies. And yes, that is true. But I also feel like the more that they're caught in their lies, the more the lies are publicized, and the more that at least state-level judges attempt to make a stand, the more cases that end up at the Supreme Court, it makes it harder for the Supreme Court to simply put everything Trump's way, right? It forces them to make a decision and to draw a line. If there is no line, then we will find that out. If the Supreme Court will literally just do everything that Trump says or put everything in his favor, then that's a clear signal that fascism is here and has succeeded, that Donald Trump has held on to power. So while I wouldn't necessarily call this a win that they were caught in a lie yet again, it does continue to give more opportunities for us to discover and find out where things truly stand and if the law can prevail and to what degree. Okay, last one here. This is a PBS NewsHour report. It says, quote, military personnel seek legal advice on whether Trump-ordered missions are lawful. And we've talked a lot about this idea that the military and National Guard, they should be not obeying any illegal order. It's part of their oath. And in the most cases that this has been talked about, it's been in regard to the National Guard being deployed against its own citizens. Well, this article is not talking about the National Guard. It's actually talking in regards to the bombing of boats in the Caribbean. It says military service personnel have been seeking outside legal advice about some of the missions the Trump administration has assigned them. The strikes against alleged drug traffickers and deployments to U.S. cities have sparked a debate over their legality. So this interview done by Amna Nawaz of PBS, she talks to someone named Lieutenant Colonel Frank Rosenblatt, who is part of an operation called the Orders Project. It was started 5 years ago as a place where military personnel can get legal advice that's independent from the Defense Department. She says, tell me about the calls you have been receiving specific to those U.S. military strikes on boats. How many calls and what are people asking? He says, the phone has been picking up a bit, our activity in the past 3 months, and some of these have related to the new military activities in the Caribbean. We are primarily getting calls, a lot of people who are tangentially involved. They aren't the people who are actually on the operations or are approving them, but many of these are. They're performing some sort of role in between, a staff officer who's asked to apply their expertise. And they have been reaching out to us when they have been concerned that the answer that they're given is or has been very disfavored. and they're feeling pressure from their higher-ups to convert their answer into something that is a little, to change a concur from a non-concur to a concur. Nawaz responds and says, in other words, pressure to get on board with the decision to carry out the strikes. Is that what you're saying? And he says, yes. And then she says, and related to the National Guard deployments, you told my colleague earlier you're also fielding calls related to that. What are those questions? He goes on to explain a little bit just about the types of questions that people are asking, military members are asking, which are the types of questions you would expect in this case. Essentially, questioning the legality, where the Trump administration is, of course, assuring that these are legal orders, and those outside of it are saying it's illegal. So who do they follow? He ended that quote by saying, as for the orders project, we have tended to receive most of our calls from military officers rather than lower-ranking enlisted members. He says that he thinks that's the case because lower enlisted members are more likely to obey an order by a higher-up if they're told to do something, whereas some of the military staff officers are actually involved in the implementation and planning of those missions. And so not only are they able to gain more insight, but they understand more that they're pushing boundaries and that they want to understand if they are legal or not. This is a win in my book simply just because it shows that questions are being asked inside the military, that there is some distrust, that it's not all simply blindly following orders, and that the Trump administration has not completely purged the military of those who seek to live up to their oath. What the actual numbers are and percentages and those types of things, I have no idea. But I continue to hope that there are some there that might stand up to him. All right, I know this has been a little bit of a different episode in regards to fascism this week. I would not say that I am feeling optimistic about the situation. I don't feel that our political situation here is simply going to resolve. But it does feel like this week and last, there's just been a slight tone shift. And my hope is that the momentum shifts with it, that there is a change and sway in public perception, in the perception of many MAGA followers themselves, in, you know, understanding the severity of what's happening with the Epstein files, the fact that economically things are not going the way that Trump promised. And 1 year into his campaign, he is blatantly lying about having fixed all of our economic issues, that things are getting so much cheaper, that everything is 25% cheaper this year than last. People are feeling the effects of the economic downturn, including and perhaps especially Trump's most staunch supporters. So hopefully we'll start to see a sway in momentum there. Anyway, let me know your thoughts. Are you feeling that way at all? Do you see any shift in momentum? Do you feel that Donald Trump may be finding the limits of his powers? We'll see in the coming weeks and months how he reacts to this. Does he become powerless, much like we saw in his first term, where he simply couldn't accomplish the things that he was set out to do? Or is he going to double down and do that much more, work that much harder to consolidate power, to get around the legal limits trying to stop him? And do we see things accelerate further? We will find out. Thanks for being here. Bye. Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.